Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge, and joining me for this episode, returning at long last, is John Mills. John, welcome back to the show.
I'm a little bit disoriented because this is not a sequel.
I was about to say, I don't even know why we're doing this. This feels like wrong. It just feels wrong to me. I feel icky.
Although I will say our discussion about the Wild Bunch was great fun. And, so maybe that was our reset point. That freed me from the sequel.
So far in 2019, we haven't done a sequel technically. So maybe this is an opportunity to start fresh.
Or to start an online petition for Wild Bunch 2.
Let's do both. Why not both? But this is, you know, we can kind of call this a spiritual prequel, if you will, to Pan's Labyrinth. And the movie we'll be discussing, of course, is Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone, which John has never seen. It's one of my personal favorite films. And the parallels between this and Pan's Labyrinth have been pointed out many times by the director himself, but there are similarities. I'm not sure. How recently have you seen Pan's Labyrinth? Is it familiar enough that you could
call it to mind? I think that I've only seen it once, and it was a few years ago, but it made an impression. Like, that movie definitely made an impression.
Lots of, in terms of tonally, in terms of the backdrop, in terms of the way the fantastical interacts with the reality, there's a lot here. I don't want to spoil anything, obviously, since you haven't seen it. But what's fun to talk about, I think, specifically, just, I love that I get to watch this movie with you, because one of our earliest experiences when we first met was the general clashing of tastes. It's specifically around Star Wars, Batman, and Guillermo del Toro. And you were firmly, when we first met, in the anti-Guillermo del Toro camp. And I have been a staunch fanboy since the fateful day I saw Blade 2 for the first time.
Yes.
But I want you to walk me through this, walk the audience through this, just kind of what you'd seen that you didn't like, and then how you kind of eventually were won over.
Well, let's go ahead and go in the Wayback Machine to the year 1997 when I saw Mimic in the theater.
Oh.
And it was to the point, I saw it with Joey, who was actually with us on a Twin Peaks episode.
That's right.
I've known him for many, many years, as you can tell. And we broke down to quietly, with whispers, heckling the movie pretty much about halfway through. And it was one of those things where my brain at one point, I haven't revisited it since. I'm terrified to go back and watch and be like, I don't know, it's not that bad. Like, okay, good.
Not to interrupt this amazing story, but there is a director's cut that is at least worth watching. It is worth watching, if not a major improvement, but absolutely worth watching for the commentary that Del Toro does alone. Because he is not a fan of Mimic either, but
okay. Continue. Well, then I have that in common with him. But yes, I was holding a grudge for Mimic because I remembered it as just a terrible experience. I did not care for it at all. Made fun of it for years. And then I loved Blade, and then Blade 2 comes along, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, I'm down with Blade 2. And there were some choices he made that at the time I didn't agree with, that I didn't care for. He violated something that I've sort of like calmed down about over time, but he violated one of my pet peeves that I used to have, which was he retold the story of the first movie over the credits of the second movie.
Which a great Wesley Snipes voiceover.
Yeah, Blade, which I hated all the way back to Superman 2.
I have all of their strengths, none of their weaknesses.
And that was a little much. And it was one of those movies where I watched and I was like, I really like these concepts and I really like the designs, but the movie itself isn't great. I've since gone back and rewatched Blade 2 and I've softened on it. Like, I got a kick out of it. I rewatched it because of I was revisiting like Donnie Yen movies because of Rogue One or something like that. And so I've softened over the years or whatever, but you considered it a sort of like a personal mission to help rehabilitate my opinion of Guillermo del Toro. But I do have to say that probably the movie that helped me the most wasn't Pan's Labyrinth, but Pacific Rim.
Yeah, we saw that together.
Yeah, that was a movie where I was amazed. Like, it did everything that it's not as good as Star Wars, but it did everything that Star Wars did, where it took all of the type of stuff that growing up I loved and mashed it together and made a different thing. But it was all familiar enough that I loved what I was watching. And so, yeah, like Pacific Rim, I was like, okay, maybe this cat's got some talent I can
right.
get into.
Right, and Pacific Rim opened the doors for you to at least be interested in having that conversation. Like, you were like, all right, fine, what's next? And I don't remember why, but I think I lent you Kronos and not The Devil's mm-hmm. Backbone. And I'm not sure what the decision was behind it, because Devil's Backbone, I think, is the superior film, but... I lent you Kronos, and it's interesting, the movies you've listed, one of the things I love about Del Toro so much is every movie he makes is so personal to him. Mimic excluded. that was a personal film that got ripped away from him. But every film is personal, and it doesn't matter if it's ridiculous, insane kung fu vampires fighting each other, or giant robot smashing monsters, or like more intimate, fantastical dramas that are very serious. He loves them all equally. And I always found it interesting in our conversations. And what was frustrating for me is, and I think you'd seen Pan's Labyrinth at that point too, right? And you were kind of like, yeah. But I was always frustrated because I was like, you've only seen like, you know, Mimic and Blade 2. You've got to see like his earlier stuff and just kind of see where he came from. And bringing up Mimic is so great because, so his first film was Kronos, which you enjoyed.
Oh, yeah. No, I did. You loaned me Kronos, and I was like, wow, okay. I really like this. This is
right.
This is
and,
good.
So he did Kronos, and then Mimic was his next film. And that was his first studio film, and it was a nightmare. Like, literally, it's some of the funniest stuff I've ever heard. His stories about, just his horror stories about his experiences making Mimic. And it so just screwed him up and so made him disillusioned with Hollywood that actually New Line Cinema came knocking on his door after Kronos. And Mimic was a box office success, enough to make some even worse sequels, at least. And but they'd really liked what he'd done with Kronos, and they said, hey, we'd love for you to direct Blade 2. And Del Toro found himself at a crossroads where he was like, I love these conversations. New Line Cinema is really like, it's feels like it's a better relationship already than I had with Miramax making Mimic, but I need to do something personal. I need to just remind myself why I love making movies. I can't go off and make a Hollywood movie with a subject matter that I'm not necessarily invested in. I have to do something personal. And New Line Cinema, to their credit, I think it was it Bob Shea? Bob Shea was the head of New Line?
Yeah, I think so.
I want to say Bob Shea, and if I'm wrong, then whatever. But he... To his credit, they were like, well, wait, we want you so bad, we'll put Blade 2 on hold until you're ready to come direct it. And the movie Del Toro made in the meantime was Devil's Backbone. So this was very much his attempt to kind of get back in touch with the reasons he loved making film in the first place. And I saw Devil's Backbone... I saw it, I think my sophomore year of college. It was my first year, my freshman year, I'd taken online courses, so it was my first year away from home, and I was just really, like, I was like, I've got to watch all these movies, and Del Toro, I was already a fan of. I loved, I'm a big fan of Blade 2, I really loved Hellboy, but I realized I hadn't seen Devil's Backbone, and I was like, this is a movie that people praise a lot, it's early on in his career, and a lot of people referenced it in relation to Pan's Labyrinth. So I was like, I should check it out. So I watched it and was just completely blown away by it. And it, to this day, I think it might be his best movie. It's a tough call. But that's personally, I think it's a runner-up at least. Like, I would probably, my personal list would probably have Hellboy very high, like the first two Hellboys, or to me, the only two Hellboys very high on that list. And I think Pan's Labyrinth and Devil's Backbone would have to duke it out for the top spot. So it's a film I really, really love. And of course, I don't want to say too much about it, but do you know anything about it at all?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I know nothing. I, in fact, know that I confused it for something else at one point.
That what I was think, that?
I don't know. It either had Devil or Bone in it, or like it's a Jennifer Lawrence movie.
Winter's Bone?
Yeah, that's the one. There you go.
I mean, pretty much the same thing.
You know, the thing is, there are a lot of movies out, so I got a little confused. But no, you know, it's something where I'm vaguely aware of it. I'm interested to see it. You know, you've got high praise for it, and it's just been such an interesting journey because it's you know, I consider Guillermo del Toro to be a very fascinating artist in the fact that I can look at my own relationship to his work as an example of not just, you can't just discount somebody because of one movie you disliked. They're still all artists working at, you know, trying to get something done. Mm. And, you know, there are various reasons why a movie can go wrong and all of that stuff. But also with my own, my own growing appreciation for his work, I think also can speak to how your own tastes change over time. It's possible that me from, you know, Mimic time frame would see Devil's Backbone and be like, eh. But I feel like I'm the type of, my tastes are at a point where it's like, I'm ready to see Devil's Backbone with a clean slate in front of me.
Yeah, you know, I'm happy we're watching it now as opposed to when, before you'd seen Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
I guess is what I should say. But I, that's fantastic. I think that's that.
Yeah.
We should get to it and just watch this movie immediately.
Yes, let's do it.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. John, tell me, what did you think of The Devil's Backbone?
I think it is a subdued, quiet little masterpiece that was extremely compelling and at one point moved me almost to what a human being would call tears and real emotion.
But what would you call it, John?
Weakness. That is what I would call it.
Well, I'm thrilled to hear that. I had a wonderful time rewatching this as well. Wonderful in the sense that this is a truly amazing filmmaker finding his stride. Getting to watch that. The film itself, the subject matter isn't necessarily wonderful. It's a really tragic and heartbreaking film, which I've seen it a couple times, but this viewing, I think in particular, I was very struck by just how, like you said, it's very moving. I was very moved a couple times, and but I think I was able to appreciate it a whole lot more. I feel like the first time I watched it, I was just, you know, completely enthralled. The second time you watch it, you have your expectations from the first viewing. So I felt like my second viewing was a little tempered. And then this time just felt a little more balanced. Like I was able to appreciate it more than I had the first couple times. But I'm so glad that you enjoyed it.
Yeah. The thing that I love, that I have come to love, I should say, about Del Toro is that the term has been thrown around by other filmmakers from time to time about subverting expectations. And I think that Del Toro is an example of a filmmaker who knows how to do that and knows how to play with the way you expect a story to go and not messing with the audience, but turning things around in such a way that you don't even realize that he's messed with a quote unquote rule about a thriller or about, like, a lot of people love to throw around the whole thing about Chekhov's gun, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, you see the guns. So how many people have it built into their little lizard brain? And we're going, we're full spoiler, right?
Yeah, we're spoilers.
Okay. How many people, like me, in the little part of your brain, the second you see that bomb in the courtyard, you think, oh, it's going to go off at some point. Mm. It's got to explode. I mean, something's going to happen. Something's going to happen to a kid on that. And it doesn't. It's just that thing that is a brilliant symbol that Del Toro brings in, like so much of the stuff, say, in like Pan's Labyrinth or something, that's that it's the constant reminder. Mm. It's the weight that's sitting on everybody's consciousness of the world that they're living in, the constant danger.
Yeah.
Even though this thing is supposed to have been taken care of, you can't help but be afraid of it and marvel at it and wonder about it.
Yeah, and I just think same sense in a way that's the physical embodiment of the ghost. This thing that just it is always present, always putting you on edge. It's a brilliant storytelling device, and I wish I'd had. I wanted to go back and watch Del Toro's commentary, and again for any Guillermo Del Toro fans, and also to you, John, I would say if you haven't listened to a Guillermo Del Toro commentary, you're missing out on one of the great joys, because this is a filmmaker who has so much love for his craft and so much understanding of his craft that every little detail is so thought out, even things you would never think about. Even films like Pacific Rim, I remember he was talking about how, and I can't remember the main character's name, but the girl who is, as a child, her parents were murdered by kaiju, and she kind of runs. So he talks about how the kaiju have blue blood, and from that point on, when she first encounters the kaiju, she has that blue stripe in her hair. That's kind of a representation of like she was scarred by this, and it became a part of her. But like things like that are always the way he finds the little details and the way he puts things in his movies. I wish I'd had more time to dig into the supplements on the Criterion Blu-ray, but there is so much beauty in what he does and things like that. And there's so many details, and they're on full display here, from the production design to the design of the ghost and the way the ghost kind of almost mimics the orphanage itself. I know they have, I don't know if you can really tell because of the makeup and the special effects, but it has kind of rust tear stains that are on display all over the orphanage. So it's almost like this creature is part of the building and the setting.
Well, and there's also something that it's so jarring about Del Toro is that he's always certain, like the sense that you're always left with is, you know, in American cinema, I think you could argue that when we go into the past for things from the World War II era, or even in the country's past to deal with a harsh or sad topic, something we don't like to relive, but we remind ourselves of because this was a difficult period and we need to learn the lessons from it. This is a lot like what struck me about Pan's Labyrinth, where what is remarkable is man's inhumanity toward man. You know, people, how they treat other people. Mm. And that the true horror is you have this Spanish Civil War going on, but the true horror is the fact that people are willing to do it to each other. Mm. That, you have Jacinto willing to completely betray the people that cared for him, that loved him. And so you see this whole microcosmic thing, but you come to understand, I think, in Guillermo del Toro's worldview, that these larger tragedies can't happen without the the personal tragedies that occur. They're all reflections of each other. And I think that this film does a tremendous job of really reinforcing that worldview.
Well, it's not even without its sense of sympathy for Jacinto. Like he is such a horrible person, and something Del Toro, as you pointed out, really loves to do. And it's really, and he said it, and I know I said it in part one, but this and Pan's Labyrinth are so they are almost, they're, he calls them, Devil's Backbone is the brother film and Pan's Labyrinth is the sister film. They're sibling films. The themes are so parallel and you can see it. But one of the big things, like you pointed out, is the main villain in an American film, it's set up the monster is the villain. The monster is what you fear. And in this, he shifts sympathies from the monster to you become sympathetic towards the monster. It's something unknowable and something terrifying, and you quickly find out it's something heartbreaking and sad that is deserving of your sympathy, and that the human characters are the ones that you should be afraid of. And he really embraces that with Pan's Labyrinth, with the I don't remember if he was a general or a colonel, but that character who is so horrifying. And you almost are more on edge when he's on screen than when any monster is on screen. And one of Del Toro's intentions with Santi, the ghost in this film, is by the end of it, I think it was Ebert who said, you know, the only thing I'd complain about is that by the end of the film, I wasn't really scared of the ghost anymore, and it wasn't really that scary. And Del Toro was like, that was 100% intentional. You're not supposed to be scared of the ghost by the end of the film. You're supposed to be on its side. But I love that. I love that the human characters are the ones committing the true atrocities. And Del Toro has always been sympathetic towards monsters. You see it in nearly every one of his films, even up to Shape of Water earned him an Oscar for the more pronounced theme in the way he kind of embraces the monster and loves the monster. But it was so great. I mean, this feels so confident. I mean, I admire his work, and I've always loved his work, but watching Devil's Backbone, it's his third film, and you just feel, I just felt it watching it. I was like, this is somebody who is finally feeling in control. And it's so amazing and pleasing to watch that, especially after a film like Mimic, where he was probably so down on himself and feeling very like, can I even do this? I don't know if he ever had a crisis of conscience or ever felt like unconfident that he couldn't do it, but it is so, I don't know. It was so wonderful to watch this movie. And then he followed it up with Blade 2. How about that?
You know, it's funny though, because I guess you could then do sort of like a, that sort of roller coaster thing where you can see, you know, what's paying the bills and what's his true love. And in a sense, you could see a reflection, you know, I don't know if I'm supposed to, you know, cross myself or, you know, do a sign against the evil eye for the heresy I might be saying here, but, you know, latter Spielberg, he makes Ready Player One so that he can fund, you know, the paper, you know, like, and you see that sort of like up and down with it, where it's like, you look for the more personal film because you're like, ah, that's the one he's invested in. Yeah. That's the one I'm going to go see.
And it's so funny because Del Toro is, he insists, even Mimic is the only exception, but for every one of his films, he finds something personal about it. And he talks about like these big films are just as personal and important to him as the smaller ones. Mm. And I think, as you're saying, they have to be personal, because he's like, yes, they mean a lot to me. And I'm like, I'm sure they do. They're paying your way so you can make your other films.
But, you know, as I was saying earlier in the episode, like, I've warmed up to Blade 2 over time. Number one, because there are so many great ideas that he then turned around and brought back for The Strain, which is, if anybody has not seen that series, please go see that series. It's an incredibly great vampire series. Mm. But like with Blade 2, there's a more humanizing exploration of the vampire subculture, as it were.
Yeah.
You talked about finding sympathy for the monsters, and the monster you meet in Blade 2 is an horrific vampire. He's like the Lenin of vampires, leading the revolution against the Tsarist regime, and there's like blood everywhere.
Yeah.
And you wind up with, you know, Blade's assault team, like seeing them as people as opposed to vampires, and then you wind up feeling sympathy for, you know, this insane monster by the end, because you realize what he's coming from is this place of pain.
Mm.
And I know this seems like a long way to get there, but again, with Jacinto, you see that in him too, when he's looking at the photograph of him as a kid and seeing that even back then people were talking about how, you know, the prince without a kingdom.
Yeah.
And, you know, you come to wonder, would he have turned out differently if he'd just been loved a little bit more?
Right. I love that. I love how simple it could have been for any, maybe another filmmaker to cut that scene or for it, yeah. for a studio to say like, oh, do we need that beat? And it's like that humanizes him so much. And he's a character that doesn't, it's not like that beat then justifies or forgives him of what he's done before, but it does paint a picture that's more complex than if he was just like, ah, I'm mm-hmm. just an angry kid who grew up. It's you see that sadness and that kind of longing, and he's an orphan just like all these other kids. He could not escape this place. It's like this place that everybody is a ghost. You know, the opening line of the film is, you know, mm-hmm. what is a ghost? Everyone in this film is essentially a ghost. They can't leave this place. It's become their lives, and they're all trapped there by circumstance, by love, by a relationship to somebody else, but they are all stuck there together. Yeah. And everyone is broken. I don't know. I mean, it that's what struck me about this viewing is just how truly tragic the film feels. It does. I mean, Pan's mm-hmm. Labyrinth, I think, is the closest comparison. And you see it in a lot of Del Toro, mostly his Spanish language films. He touched on it a little bit in Crimson Peak, which is a film I would love to watch again. I really enjoyed it. But it feels like with his Spanish language films in particular, he really tones himself down. Like, can you imagine if you had only mm-hmm. seen Blade 2 or Pacific Rim, and then this was the movie you saw without knowing anything about Pan's Labyrinth or Shape of Water, just the whiplash of thematic mm-hmm. thematic elements and tone that this movie creates.
And that's something I definitely would say as well, is that watching this made me very much regret not being somebody who can speak or understand Spanish fluently, because there is a lot of subtlety in the performances that those subtitles aren't grabbing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very visual component that you have to keep up with the subtitles, not that they're flying by or anything like that, but you have to pay attention to the subtitles while also looking at some very subtle changes and cues, which I think speaks to, you know, one of the great things about Del Toro is, you know, his work with Guillermo Navarro, who is a tremendous director of photography. Mm. And what I found amazing about the film is it looks so, and this is going to sound weird, and it's going to sound very like less of a compliment than I intend it, but a lot of movies set back in the 1930s, 40s time period, that sort of, or before or whatever, they attempt that photographic quality and they don't quite get it. It looks very manufactured. Whereas this at many points looks like that living photograph that so many people go for and works so well. And there's even, slight, and this is, you know, this speaks to the production design and costuming as well, that, you know, when you see the crime that motivates everything from the beginning, you know, what is a ghost and everything, the color palette, you know, it drains of its vibrance. Everything is drained of its vibrance. But when you see that flashback in the beginning and the end, the boy's clothing is more vibrant.
Yeah.
You see this, even the clothing speaks to the loss of innocence and the sadness that has gripped everyone. In the Civil War and in this time period.
Yeah, this is one of the most beautiful films I think I've ever seen, and it's one of, I don't want to spill the beans, but I think this might be my favorite of his films, and a lot of that is there, for me personally, any film that's about a young boy kind of coming of age story, this is sort of that, that always gets a extra bonus points from me. But it's this sense of, like, everything in this film. I love the way it looks, and I love the slowness of it. It's not mm-hmm. really, it's not like a boring film. Like, it's not even slow-paced in the way that 2001 A Space Odyssey is. But we're trained so much, I think, by modern horror, some of the more mainstream modern horror, to mm-hmm. expect, like, jump scares, and this thing's going to get you, and it's always horrifying. This film is terrifying at points, but it's almost, it, there's a ghost in it, and that qualifies it as a horror film, and the themes of it, the tragedy of it, qualifies it as a horror film for me. But for the most part, there isn't, it's not like a boo, gotcha type scary yeah. movie. And I wonder sometimes if people, like, this ends up on a lot of lists of, like, the 100 greatest horror movies of all time. And I wonder if some people have been turned off by the film just because of the fact that it's more thoughtful than that. And it's more tragic and emotional yeah. than a lot of horror films you tend to see.
I would be down with that. I would have trouble classifying this as horror. Like, thriller, I could see. Horror, I can't, because it's a, I mean, the closest it gets, I guess, to qualifying as a horror is, you know, that you have the presence of the supernatural, but the dreamlike quality, or rather nightmarish sort of tension that it has. It's the fear of what's in the basement, what's that shadow coming up the stairs, yeah. what's that thing coming for me, and that's why it's such a big moment when Carlos says, I'm not afraid of you. I want you to tell me what you want.
Yeah.
And it's this, which is a beautiful moment in and of itself, where you find out the ghost has just been trying to communicate with everybody.
Yes.
Just, you know, somebody tell my story, which, you know, gives a whole, you know, I think it's pronounced Jaime?
Jaime.
The fact that that boy is carrying it around, like, you know, that there, the ghost really is, to speak to the, you know, the opening and closing voiceovers, you know, it's the pain that won't go away, the tragedy that repeats itself. All of these people are living with Santi's memory. Mm. Some people know what happened, some people do not, and the audience has one impression at the beginning and a different realization at the end, which actually called to mind for me a very Christopher Nolan-esque sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, the ending winds up being very much like, not the showier reveals of, like, Inception or mm-hmm. anything like that, but something more along the lines of The Prestige, where when you get to the end of The Prestige, your feeling is, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, because I did not see that coming. They paint Jaime as, like, he's the bully, and everything yeah. in the film reinforces that. And you have some sympathy for him. The film builds sympathy for him. But then at the end, when it has that reveal, it's exactly like, of course, that makes so much sense. And it enriches the film, and it lends it just that air of sadness. I mean, it is such a heartbreaking film. And nobody... Yeah. Really, the kids survive at the end. These terrible things happen. People die, and the boys survive. But for the most part, nobody gets any satisfaction except for Santi, I guess, is the only character that gets what he wants. At the end, he yeah. finally gets his revenge.
Yeah, and speaking of the sadness and the unfulfilled nature of things, the character named Conchita... who's Jacinto's, you know, main squeeze, who he later kills.
Yeah.
That moment where, and the thing is that this speaks again, I think, to the understated nature of things with Del Toro when he's, you know, you talked about, like, you get whiplash if you watch Blade 2 and then this, you're like, this is the same guy?
Yeah.
because her character moment when she knows full well she's making the decision that he's going to kill her for. Mm-hmm. But, and there's no big swell of music. There's no big, you know, heroic shot or anything. It's simply somebody accepting what's going to happen. And yeah. the actress gives such a beautifully understated performance where you can see the switch go off. And she just says, no, you know, like, you're going to do what you do. You know, like, nothing's going to change it at this point.
And by that point, yeah, she's ready to take her stand, which is a really beautiful moment. And I loved Jaime and Jacinta. This is something Del Toro pointed out. They're the only characters with the names that start with J in this film, because he wanted them to be, like, Jaime is the young version of Jacinto. Like, Jacinto is what Jaime could grow up to be without love and friendship and that willingness to open up and be loved. And that was something that really affected me this time around, and affected me before, but this I took particular notice this time. I really loved the relationship between Jaime and her and the way they build that up. And I loved the conclusion to that little story. Just when she goes off to try to help them, to save them, and he gives her the grain of strength and she's got his ring on and they have that little moment together. It's just really beautiful. This movie is full of just amazing character beats. I think the moment that really got me emotionally this time was when the doctor, I can't remember the character's name, but he plays the main character in Kronos. It's Federico Lupi, I think is how you pronounce his name. But he plays Dr. Casares, and Marisa Paredes plays Carmen. And there's this beautiful unrequited love story there.
Oh my gosh.
This movie is so damn sad. But like, basically the doctor has been in love with her. She had a husband who went off to the war and left her behind. And the doctor has always been there for her, and he's impotent. So there's he can't give her what she desires. And it's not a superficial desire, but it's painted in a way that's like this almost sinful thing that keeps them apart. And her relationship with Jacinto is very much an indulgence of her flesh. And it keeps her from the thing that is meaningful, truly meaningful, the love that could have been truly meaningful.
Right. And you see, and that's the thing that hurts so bad, is he never stops loving her. And you even see, speaking back to the production design and the cinematography, that her room is in these very, warm, I don't want to say passionate, but they're more, more sensual sort of colors and lighting and stuff like that. And his room is very dark and bluish and gray.
Very stark.
And it's
like the scene where she's with Jacinto. He can hear them in the other room, and he's the reflection of him in the mirror, and the lighting and the framing of that shot, just the loneliness and the emptiness you feel in that moment is so powerful. And there's a really beautiful moment that they plant early on where he reads poetry and she can hear him through the wall. And then at the end, when she is mortally wounded, he recites a poem for her as she passes away. And it's just like these very small, stunning moments. And horror for me, it really, on a superficial level, horror is about being scared. It's about, like you said, the shadows and the night. There's plenty. The imagery of this film is absolutely horror. It's the genre. You get these amazing moments where Carlos sees the shadow through the blanket, the curtain, like things like that that are so haunting. I love the moment I think that really gets me every time is when you see Santi at the end of the hall, and he opens the closet door to hide, and then he turns and Santi's right there, and you do not expect it. It's not a jump scare. It is not, like, there's no loud noise. Like, a generic horror film would have been like, and like, you know, an audience would have. It's just literally, you do not expect it, and it's more terrifying, I think, than any other film that would try to milk that scare for you. And then, of course, it's followed by the film's only real generic jump scare. I feel like he was like, I have to have one. But when Carlos is looking through the doorway and then the ghost pops up. But like, to me, one of the true elements of horror is there's this undercurrent of tragedy, of like broken promises, of characters failing or not getting what they want. And that, to me, is something that's often forgotten about this genre when we're talking about maybe bigger films or more entertaining films. I think some of the best horror films of all time have that undercurrent of tragedy that really enriches what you're seeing. And I think it's on full display in The Devil's Backbone as well.
Well, I think that possibly, what it addresses is this idea that any genre is a larger tent than people give it credit for sometimes. You have, you know, you have the whole, it's not a line. There's a big, circular area, you know, like in a Venn diagram sort of thing. And everything is mulling around. And so you have Del Toro's type of horror over here, and you have James Wan's type of horror over here. And occasionally they can cross over and have similar moments, but you know, so you can, that, you know, they borrow certain things, but it would be nice to see a return, because Del Toro's sensibilities are much more along the lines of like the original Frankenstein, or even Branagh's retelling of the story, and you know, the original story itself of like how tortured the monster is. It's like, why am I alive?
Right.
You know, or even later tellings of Dracula. Well, I mean, actually, if you go back to the first cinematic ones, like the book Dracula, there's nothing romantically motivating him. He's just a pure evil force. Whereas the cinematic ones have really cast Dracula in the sense of, especially Coppola's version, or even I will make a really, I guess some people might find it an unfortunate call out, but Dracula 2000, which I found to be a delightful little gem for the record, everybody, deals with this idea of Dracula is not, he is a malevolent force, but he's a tortured malevolent force. He doesn't want to be the way he is. He just doesn't know another way to be. And so I would love, you know, there's always this talk about Universal bringing its horror franchises back. And it's like, why aren't you tapping somebody like Del Toro? He would know what to do with them.
Yes.
Like, I would love to see a Frankenstein movie made by Del Toro.
If you were to have anyone be the Kevin Feige of that universe,
yeah,
it would be Del Toro.
Yeah. Exactly. And the thing is, it's tough to talk about this like a horror film, because there are so many moments in it that are an embrace of the macabre reality of the world, as opposed to the fantastical, you know, just those fantasies that can come to life on screen and stuff like that.
A lot of films would, once they dip into the fantastical, really embrace that, and all of a sudden you're in this magic. Same with Pan's Labyrinth. A lot of people complain about Pan's Labyrinth to this day because of the fact that it's so grounded and so brutal, which was fully the intention. But it's the same thing with Devil's Backbone. It's very, you never give yourself completely over to the fantastical. It never becomes like, and now we've got to escape this monster. How are we going to get out of this orphanage? Oh my gosh, it's after us. You know, it is very just somber and slow and thoughtful and methodical in its pacing. And that's not to say, I mean, I love like more bonkers horror, like more entertain, like The Evil Dead. I mean, Sam Raimi, but the stuff that really gets under my skin are movies like The Devil's Backbone, where you can't dismiss it so easily as like, oh, that was real scary, and that was fun. It's not like a fun house ride. It's almost like going into an art museum and kind of admiring the works of.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of it's like when you go into those museums that have like you know, the skeletons and the mummies and the coffins and stuff like that, and you sort of like walk through that section and you're just kind of like, "Urgh." In all honesty, the most horrifying moment of it, and this speaks again to what we've been talking about, the theme of like how humans on a personal level are the real monsters sort of thing. That scene where Dr. Casares is in town and the rebels are rounded up and one by one turned around to face the wall and shot in the back, like, and it doesn't show them being shot. It shows Dr. Casares jumping with each shot. He never, you know, that this is something he cannot get used to. While another guy nonchalantly walks over and says, "Friends of yours?" You know, like the fact that you care that a human being is being killed is, oh, you must be a sympathizer. It's right. Like, no, I'm a human being.
Right.
How could you not look at that and be horrified?
That scene's a really good example of the way the film won't let you off the hook. Like, it's not like a thing where there's a body count that's to be celebrated. Like, yes, the monster killed this many people. It's the thing where you're truly terrified and you're truly scared for, oh my God, Jacinto's back. Are these kids going to get killed? Like, you fully believe he would kill them. And that's more monstrous than a ghost chasing you through the corridors. It's the true terror of the film.
You know, it is so telling as well, because Del Toro, and I think this is pretty consistent, he very much points to, and I think a lot of filmmakers have done this through time, of always showing that it's the next generation. They'll take it upon themselves to find the way out, to find the way to heal, that even when the world is depressing and sad and difficult, the kids, they're the ones that will clean it up. We have to have faith that those kids will open that door. We have to have faith that they're going to make it to the town, that they're going to be okay, that they're going to find a way to survive. Yeah. We don't look at the end of the film. You're not left with the sense of like, oh, well, those kids are screwed. Yeah. Good luck, guys. You have the sense of, they're going to make it. This is a terrible place for them to start from, but they can go on. They can survive.
Yeah, that's the sense I got from the ending is ambiguous, of course. It shows them kind of walking off.
Yeah.
While the ghost of the doctor kind of watches them. But that's the sense I got. It wasn't a sense of hopelessness, like, oh, here they go. It was a sense of, like, this is just the first step of a longer journey. And hopefully a more victorious one. Is there, watching the film, was there anything that caught you really off guard? Like, you were expecting one thing and it kind of threw, I know we talked a little bit about the plot twists and things like that, but was there anything that like really impressed you as far as you weren't expecting it to go in a particular direction?
Yes.
Or anything like that?
I think that Carmen and Jacinto's relationship, that was really the moment where that got under my skin really in a pronounced way. I really was uncomfortable there. Not so much that I'm going to turn this off and I'm offended, sort of uncomfortable, but uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, it still felt like, oh, of course. Yeah. Yes, of course, this is that.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's that immediate grim acceptance of, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
But it's not sensationalized. Like, their affair is not something where it's like, oh yeah, this is so steamy. It's treated as kind of a sick and disturbing thing, which I think is why you can watch it and not be like, oh God, I want to turn this off. It's because the film is sympathetic towards that. It's like, yeah, this is screwed up, this relationship. And it's Carmen's tragedy that she is just, she can't break this cycle. That she and they, it's clearly something that's been going on for years and years. Like, neither of them can break this cycle, but her in particular, you really feel for, because she knows it's wrong and she can't stop herself. And it just, it's the sadness of, you know, she's the one character in the movie that has like an actual physical deformity. She doesn't have a leg. And I think it's that sense of, she wants to feel whole again. And she's looking in the wrong places. She thinks that it's like an indulgence that she thinks will make her feel beautiful, or whatever is creating that void in her, that will be fulfilled by this relationship. And it's not. And the horrible, sad thing is that the thing that is there for her, the one who's always been there for her, it will never be fulfilled. But that was something where I remember watching it and just being like, this is so, the film is so complex. Every character is so complex.
Yeah.
It's not, I knew then, I was like, this is not going to be as simple, like the ghost is popping out and scaring everybody. It was like, oh, this is a very intricate, very detailed. And there are a lot of layers to these characters. And I think that's crucial. And I love that they gave so much time and effort to building it up. Again, the best horror films, I think, make you care about the story. If you've seen a horror movie 1,000 times, the scares can lose their appeal and the scares can kind of disappear and just kind of lose their effect. But it's the story and the characters that really stick with you. And that's on full display in Devil's Backbone. Was there anything you noticed here? I know it's been a while since you've seen Pan's Labyrinth or maybe and Kronos as well. But was there anything you noticed here that seems to have carried on in Del Toro's filmography?
You know, I mean, the themes are always there. And I think that there's the characterizations, the complexity. I think everything that we've spoken to is sort of like the, you know, the commonality that's there. I mean, you know, calling to mind Pan's Labyrinth, you know, the people getting shot in the back of the head here is very similar to the scene where the colonel beats the guy to death. He pistol whips the guy to death, which is just this scene where it's like, stop, I don't know. Yeah. This is terrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a similar sort of thing. So I think that really what Del Toro, I would offer that what he does is he substitutes the jump scare that you're expecting with the truly horrible thing that you know happens. You know, like there's not a Michael Myers behind the door sort of moment there, but there's while you're watching the sorts of scenes that he sets up, when the humans are being terrible people, you the horror of it is you recognize how authentic it is. And so I think that is something that's a cue that he keeps in there. You know, it's almost like, let's throw down the challenge. Where do you see that in Pacific Rim? And it's like, right. Look, man, that's a different whole animal. Okay. You know, you could say that Ron Perlman's character is man's inhumanity man. Okay. But like, it's very much, I think, that sort of thing where there's, just that complexity. And that, you know, I keep going back to I think with Pan's Labyrinth, the expectation that was subverted there was that it was set in the real world. And here, the bomb doesn't go off. And so, and with Blade 2, that the monster is really just a hurt. I mean, in a sense, he's like Jacinto, where he's motivated by this pain. If somebody had loved him, maybe things could have been different.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, those sorts of elements do carry through, yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything about the film that didn't really work for you or anything that kind of was below expectations maybe?
I can honestly say no. I went into this, you know, because I knew you had such a high regard of it. I'm like, I know this is at least going to be decent, you know, but I have been struck by the fact there are a lot of movies I've been watching this year, and this is one of the ones that stuck with me. Like the last couple of days, I've really been, it's been with me, it's been there, and I keep going back to and thinking about certain scenes. And so it really, I think that this just really, you know, the word masterpiece is thrown around far too easily, but of the Del Toro movies that I've seen, and I have not seen all of them, but of the ones that I have seen, this is hands down, like, this is the one I'd pull off the shelf and be like, this is the must watch.
Yeah.
And Pacific Rim.
So what do we, what's our rating scale? What should we rate this on? Grains of strength?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Well, how many grains of strength would you give Devil's Backbone?
I look for reasons not to give this rating. I always do, but I give it 5 grains of strength.
I think it's grains of strength as well. And I think this reinforced Del Toro, I absolutely love him. I think he's one of the best filmmakers, and I can rank his movies. I can say these are my favorites. This reinforced why it's so hard sometimes, because I adore something like Hellboy. I love Hellboy 1 and 2. They're so purely entertaining, and I think he brings a lot of the same visual flourishes and details to that he brings to a film like this or Pan's Labyrinth. But like this film, there's so much going on, and it's even more impressive and thrilling to watch just in the context of knowing where he'd come from and that his previous film had been such a nightmare for him, and how important it was for him to express this very, very personal story, and that he pulled it off so beautifully, and that from this point on in his career, it felt like he was able to approach each project with confidence and kind of like, okay, I know exactly what I want to do. I know where I'll compromise, and I know where I'll draw the line and say, no, this is what it has to be. And I feel like Devil's Backbone was like, that was his, I guess, what else can I compare this to? Maybe like Taxi Driver. It's kind of like his Taxi Driver, where it's like, that's the movie where Scorsese, like everything, he'd made a couple before. Mean Streets is good. Was Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore? That was another one. But it's like, Taxi Driver was like, from that point on, Scorsese had found, that was, that Scorsese, you know, from that point on, those are the kinds of movies and that kind of style, that confidence. And I feel like Devil's Backbone for Del Toro was like, boom, that's where he found his stride. But yeah, I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
I'm glad I did too. I, you know, it's been a delight. I think I get to pick the next one though. So we'll talk about that. I hope you like Roger Corman movies. No, I'm just kidding.
We'll find out. But until then, John, you've got tons of great stuff going on the Nerd Party Network and otherwise. Why don't you tell the good folks at home where else they can find your sultry tones?
Well, right here on the Nerd Party, you can find me co-hosting two shows, Retro Perspective with Mike Schindler, where we are going through each week of 1994. One release at a time. Well, actually, we're watching as many of the releases per week as we can. And 94 is a year marked by Speed, Pulp Fiction, Shawshank Redemption, Ed Wood, and also glorious stinkers like Deadfall and City Slickers, too. So, you know, head on over to Retro Perspective if you want to hear two guys talking about both the positives and negatives of revisiting 1994. You can find me also co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, which is a Star Wars podcast. I co-host that with Matt Rushing, and it's a more free-form sort of Star Wars show than anybody is really used to, I think, where we don't have, Galaxy's Edge is its thing. We're not talking about news or anything like that. We go for the deep dive sort of stuff on Aggressive Negotiations and have a lot of fun with it. And of course, Kessel Junkie is my online name, and you can find me active every so often over on my blog, KesselJunkie.com, or on Letterboxd. So there you go. That's where they can find me, Sean. Where can they find you?
Beautiful. They can find me on the Twitter at YayShondorman, and you can also follow the Nerd Party itself at Join Nerd Party, or like the Facebook page, or follow on Instagram. It's the Nerd Party on Facebook and at the Nerd Party on Instagram. And if you like what you're hearing, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Again, I've gotten lots of really great feedback from a whole bunch of different people, and I want to thank everyone who's sent their comments and thoughts and suggestions for movies. I promise you, I am seeing those comments, and I really, really appreciate it. Feel free to rate us on iTunes, as I was saying. That's also appreciated. And thank you for tuning in. John, thank you again for the experience and the conversation. It was fantastic, as always.
Always love to be here, Sean.
Take care, everybody.